This is the MPPD Podcast, Mount Pleasant, South Carolina.
Welcome to the MPPD Podcast. I'm Officer Bill Martin. With me are my co-hosts, Inspector Don Calabrese and Lieutenant Chip Gooch. With the way the country is going right now with dealing with the COVID-19 crisis, I think it's very easy to forget about other crises that are going on in the country, specifically the opioid crisis. This is something that has been killing young and old since the 90s, and I wish I could say that Mount Pleasant is immune to this kind of thing, but it's as rampant as it is anywhere. So today we're going to be talking about the opioid crisis, and our guests today are Sergeant Tony Winstead, who runs our First Step program, Ms. Nancy Shipman and Nate Lyles from Wake Up Carolina, and Caitlin Kratz from the Charleston Center. Welcome, everyone.
Welcome.
Good morning. Good
morning, Bill.
Thank you for welcoming.
First person I want to introduce is Sergeant Winstead. He was my first supervisor when I started at Mount Pleasant Police Department, and I'm excited to work with him again. Morning, Sarge.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. You can tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yep. My name is Tony Winstead. Like Don said, I'm a sergeant here at Mount Pleasant Police Department. Started my career here January 8th, 1998. So I'm kind of at the back end of the career. And decided a couple years ago that I wanted to start really working in the field of recovery and helping individuals in our community that are struggling with the addiction to the opioids. But a little bit about myself. Like I said, I've been here about 23 years, and I've been in just about every unit, I think, other than traffic, to from patrol to training to investigations to narcotics to Office of Professional Standards. So I've seen quite a bit of the department and know quite about the functionality of everything that kind of goes into the department. But this is probably one of my most exciting and favorite positions that I've done, and it's more of a voluntary position than it's really a assigned position. But I enjoy working with the individuals that are actually sitting at this table that we formed a partnership to help individuals in the community to battle the opioid addiction.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
We're excited to have you. I know you've done so much for the department, our community, so we certainly appreciate it. And next, I want to introduce Caitlin from the Charleston Center. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for having me. I'm Caitlin Kratz. I am a licensed independent social worker and a licensed addiction counselor. I work at the Charleston Center, which is Charleston County's alcohol and drug treatment center. A little bit about the Charleston Center. We offer all levels of care for individuals struggling with substance use disorders. We have a detox unit. We have two residential units. We have adolescent services, outpatient services. We have a therapeutic daycare for children whose parents are in treatment. And also medication-assisted treatment, which is the department that I am currently the program administrator for. And our department provides the three FDA-approved medications, which are methadone, buprenorphine, and naltrexone, to treat opiate and alcohol use disorders. So our clinic is busy in treating, I think we have about 375 patients right now that we are currently treating.
Wow.
Yeah, quite a bit. It's a busy daily operation there. And our goal is providing them treatment services in conjunction with the medication to help stabilize their substance use disorder and help them live.
Is that an average number? Like, is that are we at a high point?
Right. Or? Actually, that's pretty low right now. We've actually seen, we have the capacity to have about 500 patients.
Right.
So it's pretty low right now. It ebbs and flows based on the community needs and whatnot.
Right.
Thank you for being here. We certainly appreciate the work you do.
Thank you.
And the first thing I wanted to ask you to kind of jump into it is, when we say opioids, what exactly are we talking about?
Absolutely. So opioids is the broad term that is used, and I like to not get lost in the science behind it and confuse people. So what we really, when we're talking about opioids, we're talking about your pain relievers. We all have opiate receptors in our brain, and what that means is when you take an opiate, most common ones, Percocet, OxyContin, oxycodone, fentanyl, what happens is that opiate finds its way to the receptor in the brain, and all that opiates do is diminish your perception of pain. And so that is the main goal of an opiate, that should you have a major trauma, say you broke your arm, and you're in significant pain, this medication is designed to help your body trick your mind into thinking you are not in pain. They've been around forever, and great use for them in the medical setting. But what we've seen is that they become just the chemical science behind opioids. They're highly addictive in small quantities over short periods of time. And so with that, we have seen this epidemic kind of that's been brewing over the past decades and really boomed in 2016 all the way to now. But opioids are, those pain relievers that we need. So there is need for them. But then again, as we look into this crisis now, maybe too much of a need we've seen.
Is there any kind of specific, so we're talking about prescription pills abuse for the most part that we're seeing here?
Yeah, so what we're actually seeing is, so a huge prescription pills is a huge part of it. There's a couple factors that kind of play into the epidemic. The prescription opioids, of course, being one of them, where people legitimately get a prescription for a pain reliever from a doctor, or there's some in the household. But there's also synthetically made ones. So when we're talking about that, we're talking about illegal drugs like heroin, which is what we see on the streets a lot now. So heroin is considered an opioid. It works in the same capacity, but it's usually manufactured. We see a lot of it come in from China, Mexico.
And it's a lot cheaper than the pharmaceutical grade stuff.
Absolutely. So, somebody could probably sell an OxyContin for $30 a pill and heroin for $15, and that'd be able to last them.
And of course, any kind of street drug is inherently more dangerous than a prescription drug might be, in that there could be fentanyl in it, or
and that's,
is that something you want to talk about, Tony?
Yeah, I mean, there's when you get a prescription from your doctor's office, you have a legal prescription, you go to the pharmacy, you get it filled, and you have all the medical pharmacists, professionals dealing with that. But when you're buying on the street, you have no idea what you're getting. I can tell you when I was coming out of narcotics and into another position, when I started this First Step program, there was no telling what you were going to get in any type of drug, whether it was marijuana, cocaine, meth, heroin. There was always a chance of it being laced with what is now that we recognize as one of the main killers out there is fentanyl, carfentanil, or some other derivative of fentanyl. That's being mixed in with all these illicit drugs that are being bought on the street. So yeah, it's very dangerous for anybody going out there to buy on the street.
And equally dangerous for us as officers.
Absolutely.
With going out there and you think you'd say, hey, what's this? And
absolutely.
Searching through someone's
even,
car.
Even in the Mount Pleasant Police Department.
A grain of fentanyl.
Right. Yeah, the height of the fentanyl, coming up back in, 16, 17, that time frame to where we didn't know what things were being laced with. We had to come up with protocols for officer protection because, we weren't going to test on the street anymore for certain types of drugs if we didn't know exactly what it was, just for officer safety.
Right. Anything more you wanted
to add? Well, just to put it in perspective, fentanyl is 100 times stronger than morphine, which is one of our strongest opioids we have out there. So when you talked about a small grain, you're exactly right. A little bit, if there was just a small bit of exposure in this room, it could take all of us out in this room.
Right.
So it's very small quantities is deadly, and it's just being laced in things, and people don't even know they're getting it. People are using cocaine, and it's laced in fentanyl and overdosing. So it's scary, yeah.
All right, and also with us is Nancy from Wake Up Carolina. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do over there?
Thank you so much for having us. So I'm Nancy Shipman, the founder and executive director of Wake Up Carolina. We are a community-based grassroots nonprofit that was birthed out of my family's tragedy. I lost my oldest son, Creighton, to a heroin overdose in July of 2016 after leaving treatment. So Wake Up Carolina is based on three pillars. It is awareness, education with hope, and recovery. We look at this as a family disease. Substance use disorder addiction is a family disease. So it is equally important to work with individuals and young adults as it is with families. And that's kind of the backbone of our organization. Nate Lyles is our recovery program director for Creighton's House. And I'd love to introduce you to Nate.
Absolutely. I'm so glad to be here with all of you. Again, my name is Nate Lyles, and I am the program director of Creighton's House, which is located in Mount Pleasant. But I'm also a person in long-term recovery. So that means that I have abstained from alcohol and a drug of use, which was opioids, since April 26th of 2017. So within the organization, I have the privilege of serving as the middleman, if you will, between folks that either know themselves that they are having issues with substance use disorder or family members that have loved ones that are seeking treatment or even curious about treatment or recovery. And what that looks like is a lot of different things. But first and foremost, it's working one-on-one, as well as in group settings with youth and young adults who are at a lot of different points in their potential recovery. You know, one, they might be questioning their issues with substances, or they are looking for environments for sustained recovery here in the Charleston and Mount Pleasant area. And so through relating one-on-one through peer support, I'm able to not only offer my own personal experience with my own substance use and recovery, but also we provide other peer support individuals who have also walked that walk. So we are not individuals who are shouting from the rooftops, this is what you should do. We more talk from a place of understanding why they do what they do, but also offering an alternative to ways of getting out of it in a safe, protected, kind of supported manner. So it's good to be here. Thanks.
Yeah. Congratulations on your recovery journey.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing. Thanks. Well, Nancy, I want to start with you. I want to ask you, if one of our listeners has an issue or is fighting to recover, or if they have a family member who has an issue, where do they go to get this type of help?
So the thing about Wake Up Carolina is we started out as a prevention organization, and it grew into meeting people where they are. And what that looked like is people were like, how do we get help for our loved one, our child, our spouse, or myself? And so what that looks like is we find out what you're interested in, what your willingness is, and then we look at insurance options. We look at detox, inpatient, outpatient, and figure out what the right fit is for you or your loved one. And then we have an amazing resource list of trusted partners that we try to find the natural fit. We give you options, and we also, not only for that, when your loved one goes to treatment, we also offer family support services. Because in my own journey with my son, I thought when he went to his 30-day inpatient treatment that he was going to come back all better, and it was all going to be fixed and done. And you only know what you know until you know different. And what I learned is that when Creighton was away doing his work and his counselor said, he's doing great, Nancy, but how about you? What are you doing? I immediately got irate because I'm like, are you kidding me? I am raising three kids here, got my son to treatment. I mean, I am fine. Why are you about me? But when we talk about this being a family disease and our loved one is getting their treatment, that is a time where we met that need by providing family support services. We don't provide medical services. We're gracious and thankful to have partners that are able to provide those. But what we do is we have trained family support specialists, and we have lived experience that is able to share that space with a family to talk about in an open, safe way about where you are. And so we have these family meetings while your loved one, whether it's your spouse or your child, is at treatment, that provides a safe space about where you are today, where you are during your own journey, when your person comes back. And we never tell you what to do. We sit in that space with you and share it in a safe, open, honest way. So that's the beauty of helping someone that reaches out to us for options, because it can be extremely overwhelming. At least from my experience, it's extremely overwhelming. So we are at a safe starting point.
So it sounds like each person gets individually tailorized type of program for them. It's not one size fits all. But then, as equally as important, it sounds like the family needs help, because whether you have a family member with a chronic illness or battling something, you feel lost. You don't know what to do. And
alone.
Right. And just to know that they're not alone while their loved one's going through treatment.
Right.
Or if you're the one going through treatment, you know your family's being taken care of as well. That's an important component, and I think that's an amazing
Absolutely. And we respect privacy. You know, you want to have this culture where you feel like when you come in, because for me, when I was going to my very first family meeting, it's on Daniel Island, and a lot of people think that you're all enthused to go and jazzed. When I was in Mount Pleasant driving, I got to Long Point Road and turned around. And the next week, I got up to the bridge, got to the bottom of Daniel Island, turned around. The following week, I got to the parking lot, couldn't go to the door, left, went home. And then that fourth time, I was sitting in my car. I wanted to go. I needed to go. And I was like, I can't do it. I'm scared. What was I scared of? Scared of seeing someone I might know. Scared of what somebody might think. Scared of what they might think of Creighton. And those things are all natural. But as soon as I looked up from my steering wheel in the parking spot, I saw someone I knew. I saw someone that knew Creighton. And she looked at me and blew me a kiss and said, come on. And so that's the first, it took me 4 weeks to ever go to that meeting. And for family members, those are all natural feelings, and our door is always open. But you're right, you're not alone, and it's necessary. And for when the loved one is in treatment, it's a really great thing to know that your family is also getting love and support and treatment themselves.
And getting rid of that stigma, I think, is extremely important, because that's, I think it's a huge problem with, you know, to where people are scared of, just like Nancy was saying, and you know, when I can remember working with a mom, trying to get her some Narcan in the beginning of when first step started, was she left and went two jurisdictions away to a pharmacy because she was scared that somebody would see her getting Narcan. And for this disease, you know, I think getting rid of the stigma, because, you know, we don't get upset with people that have cancer, or we don't get upset with people that have high blood pressure or diabetes, but for some reason, people seem to want to get upset with people that have a substance use disorder, regardless of what that substance is, or an addiction, or however you want to call it. But stigma is one of the things that I think everybody at this table pushes to get rid of, because once you can get rid of that stigma, you can start bringing more people together.
Right. Well, we may come back to that, but one of the stigmas that I know we hear a lot about is people worry they're going to get locked up or they're going to get arrested for that. So we may come back to that. But Nancy, so we get this question a lot when it comes to treatment. What, you know, how successful is treatment when people go through that? What is that?
So everybody at this table, I mean, don't we hear this often in our own, like,
Absolutely.
Little stake, you know, our own walks is, so they're going to be good when they get back. It's going to be a successful treatment, right? So wouldn't that be great if it was a success? What is a success? How do we determine that?
Right. I try to explain this because I work with a lot of families sometimes, too, about getting their loved one into treatment, and a lot of parents or loved ones that are desperate. You know, they're worried about, is their loved one going to make it through the night? And so I often hear that desperation, and they always think, if I can just get them in a bed somewhere, if you can keep them for 5 to 7 days and then bring them home. Well, there is no thing called an addictionectomy. You can't go into detox, we take out your disease, and then we send you home and we wish you well. That doesn't exist. This is a chronic disease, and treatment is necessary for some people. Medically necessary for people that might be withdrawing from alcohol or benzodiazepines. So there's a place for it for people, and inpatient treatment where people can go and they're with licensed professionals, with certified peer support, with medical that can help monitor them through those early stages of that. But treatment always has an end date. Recovery is forever. And so people interchange that a lot, because I think people think, you know, recovery is, it should also have an end date. Like, if I send you my child for 30 days, send them back in good condition.
And fixed.
Yeah. And so, yeah. And I think using that word fixed, you know, feeds into the stigma.
Yeah.
Or we're broken. You know, these are sick people that are just trying to get well.
It's a chronic disease with, you know, our recovery is ongoing. And that can be a frightening way for me, even though my loved one is no longer here. I always have to work on my own recovery with my other children, with my other family members and my friends. It is an ongoing process. It can be scary. But at the same time, I mean, it's also, it lightens my load.
That's another thing, too. We've talked about recovery and treatment being different than recovery, and there's no graduation date. Even within the recovery community, a lot of folks come in thinking that, all right, once I get 6 months, or once I get a year, or once I get, I can do, you know, take the alcohol out of it, but I can still do prescription painkillers or heroin from the street. You know, it's a mind game. You know, addiction is, in some senses, of course, a physical dependence, but also a disease of the mind. And I can speak on the part of recovery. You know, a lot of misconceptions too from being on the other side as a person in recovery myself. You know, ideally in a perfect world between the family and the person having an issue with substance use, we would love for the person to go to treatment and never return to use. You know, that's the gold standard of treatment / recovery. And you know, I don't know an exact statistic. That would be, I think, pretty hard to pull. But you know, a large percent of people return to use at some point in their journey of recovery. And so, what I'm trying to say is that for folks that might be listening that have had loved ones, you know, quote unquote, try out recovery or experience what recovery is, whether it's a day of sobriety or it's 20 years of sobriety and return to use, as long as that person's heartbeat is beating and that person is drawing breaths, there is hope in recovery. And I know that sounds cliche and that seems cheesy, but as long as that person is breathing, there is a chance, you know? And so,
I don't think it sounds cheesy at all. And I'll tell you what. As a patrol officer, one of the worst calls that you get is when you get stuck going with the coroner, as in, like, to go with the coroner to make a notification. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that the most soul-crushing thing in this job is to go with the coroner and have her tell some parents that their child is dead. And
those are some of the things I'll never forget from this job.
Right.
Almost 25 years in, and the handful of times I've done it, I can pretty much remember every smell, every right. sight, and everything.
Well, and the
parent.
Not something you ever want to do, and being a parent ourselves.
Of knowing that their child is gone.
Right.
You can't unhear it.
Right.
And what's worse is when you go to that house and there's no reaction, that they know it was coming.
Right.
That you walk in that door and they don't even shed a tear. They're almost, it's almost relief.
And that's just to kind of wrap up what I was, going back to the, you know, the idea of the birth of Creighton's House in 2018, that meeting, we wanted this space to be a space where the door is never shut, you know. We have folks that, you know, got out of treatment in the COVID area, and we have been able to, you know, provide a sustained place for their recovery, but that's not everybody's walk. And so, we want people to understand that we welcome people where they're at. So if they're still using, as long as it's not a harm to themselves or someone else in the group, we welcome them to walk through that door exactly as they are. So we have people from that to months of sobriety. And like people have said, the shame, the S word, is what will keep people away from recovery, but it's also what will kill people. Shame is not going to directly kill you, but it will kill you eventually.
Right.
So with this podcast, if we're able just to kind of shed light on that and just break that a little bit, like Tony said, people going two jurisdictions away to get a medication that can save someone's life because their neighbor might see them. This isn't a fight that we're going to overturn within 2 years or 5 years, but it's definitely being talked about a lot more than it has been in the last five, in my opinion.
I can't say enough about how needed this podcast is right now.
Mm-hmm.
Right. July 16th, I was putting in numbers about kind of like calls and emails, just how many we were dealing with, our serving, and I knew we were worn out. Like, I could feel it, and I was like, gosh. And when we were experiencing things, we a lot of times think it's just us. And it was odd, but not really. There's no such thing as oddities. I get an email from a friend, and it's a link. And she just said, you need to read this. And it was a New York Times link, and I clicked on it. It was from July 16th. And it showed the crisis from July 2016, which, again, that's not odd. That's when my life was forever changed. It showed the numbers of overdose deaths on a national level. And that's when we started seeing all the attention in the media, newspapers, the death rates were also through the roof. It compared those numbers to where we are right now in 2020 of June. And we have doubled and tripled on a nation from what we were at in July 2016. We have doubled our numbers, even comparing June 2019 to June 2020 in the state of South Carolina, we have doubled. And in the work that we were doing, we're gifted with working with amazing community partners, but also families that are walking their walk from the beginning and the middle, and then sometimes, unfortunately, at the end. And within this community in the Tri-County area, there were a number of two handfuls of families that lost their children, adult children and young adults. And when I read that article, I immediately thought of those faces that were no longer here, that are shining from above. And I was like, these people were in the midst of a battle. If we thought 2016 was bad, we are doubling and tripling those numbers of deaths and overdoses. And so that's when we started blowing up the phones to let people know that it's not just a Charleston thing or a Tri-County thing or a state thing. There are people dying three times and two times more than they were a year ago and 4 years ago. Yes, COVID is a major health crisis. It is deadly. But we are also dealing in times that we have never seen in a nation, in a state, in a county, and in a community to where people are dying, dying. And there are family members that are left to hold the pieces of what we do. And the beauty in August 31st being Overdose Awareness Day is that we have an opportunity to be trained for Narcan, to where that is the only tool that will reverse an overdose. And then it also honors those that are no longer here, whose lives shine from above. And for our family members to give light and love to the life they loved when lived on this earth, but also the hope in this war, this battle. But I want to thank y'all for having this today, having this podcast right now in this crisis. Crisis.
Well, it's important, absolutely, all around, no matter what the time frame is. Is the Narcan training something that's associated with Wake Up Carolina, or is that something that you partner with?
It is a partnership, and a beautiful one at that. Partnership with Wake Up Carolina, Mount Pleasant Police Department, and Charleston Center. And so pre-COVID, we were hosting on the last Saturday of every month. Here, the wonderful donated space at Mount Pleasant PD, we were hosting live Narcan trainings. So a staff member from Charleston Center would be facilitating that. And the training's basically a lot of education, signs and symptoms of an overdose, and then how you can prevent it with Narcan. Narcan is the opioid reversal medication. And at the end of it, you get a free kit of Narcan that has two doses.
Wow.
So potentially giving you the ability to save someone's life. But the best thing I have to say about that is not the training itself. It's the sense of community and the conversations that happen out after that.
I could see that.
We see people that kind of hang out 45 minutes, an hour. People that come and for the first time feel that they're in a room of, wow, somebody gets it. And for me, it's just so honoring that I can be a part of that. I've sat and trained in front of that room and trained in front of mothers and fathers that have lost their kids, and for them to be there and have the strength to walk through that door and want something different for their family, their life, or another loved one, it is incredible. So I'm so thankful for the partnership. And we will be doing a Narcan training on August 31st for overdose awareness and being able to get Narcan to people that participate via watching it live.
Yeah, that's going to be on the Mount Pleasant Police Department YouTube page. That you'll be able to watch that if you go to our YouTube page. It will be live that day on August 31st at 7 o'clock?
Yes.
Sergeant Winstead, we were talking about a stigma beforehand about people getting arrested and worrying about that if they overdose or they have any drugs in your house. Can you talk about that and talk about the First Step program and how that kind of goes into?
Yeah, so first, let me kind of explain how things used to run. And one of the greatest things about the Mount Pleasant Police Department over the years that I've been working here is everybody that works here, everybody in the leadership here are extremely progressive when it comes to community needs. They're always seeking out better ways to serve the community. And one of the things in the past, and with the opioid epidemic coming up, people were just going to jail, and they were going to jail, and they were getting out of jail, and they were overdosing once they're getting out of jail because their tolerances are less. They're going back to using the same amount prior to going being incarcerated, and we were starting to see our numbers climb, and we can get into numbers in a little bit. But to talk about the First Step program is the chief wanted a program to where we can start intervening. And if you ever listen to him speak, he always says, we cannot arrest ourselves out of this epidemic. And with that in mind, we came up with a program that we call the First Step program that was actually began in July of 2018. And the whole purpose of that in the beginning was we would intervene when officers, because typically first responders, whether it's fire or police, show up on scene first to an overdose, once the officer gets on scene, they would contact somebody like myself that's involved in the First Step program, and we would show up to either on scene or to the hospital, depending on whether they were transported or not, and we would try to intervene. We would go to the victim and say, or ask them if they needed any help and any assistance in finding treatment and so forth. And typically we'd get the answer of no, but every once in a while, the biggest things that we were dependent on is if we could just save one, you know, work one case at a time, just save one person, then we've accomplished our goals. So it was one overdose at a time. And so we were able to actually, once they get discharged from the hospital and it's 3 o'clock in the morning, we'll sit with them before at IHOP and, you know, get some pancakes and some coffee, and then we can call our partner over at the Charleston Center to get an assessment. You know, we've had several instances to where, you know, we'll call, we don't really know where to go, so we'll call the Charleston Center, or we'll call Nancy, or call Nate, and, you know, basically, as in that partnership, we've developed for the police department avenues to go, as far as we're going to show up, we're going to do our public service, our public safety part, we're going to do serve our community as far as getting people the help that they need, but we're not medical practitioners, you know. So our biggest thing is we want to get them to the medical practitioner as soon as possible, without any gap of any time gap between being released from a hospital. We've even picked people up from jail that have served, you know, a bench warrant time or something like that, to where we're there at 8 o'clock in the morning. As soon as they get released, we'll pick them up and take them to the Charleston Center for assessment and let the Charleston Center do. And at that point, you know, we might do a little bit of follow-up, but we trust in the system with our partnership that they're going to do their part like we're doing our part in getting them there. So basically the First Step program started out with just being able to intervene into somebody's addiction, to where if they want help, we're there to provide them with the avenue to get help. We were the vessel to get them help. We've kind of morphed into a little bit more now with victim advocates. Victim advocates are now part of the program, or really they started out with the program, but they're really helping the family side. So basically, with First Step, we have an avenue to go to Nancy, who deals a lot with family, or I can go to Nate, who deals a lot with people that have a substance use disorder. So, and then they will generate them to wherever they need to go, to what other resources out there in the community that will best provide the victim with help. So, so that's pretty much in a nutshell what the First Step does. But if I can, just real quick, run over a couple statistics that a lot of people may not know, because we track our overdoses and overdose deaths. So in 2019, throughout 2019, we had 19 overdoses. Out of those 19 overdoses, we had 6 deaths. And out of those 19 overdoses, 5 were females, 14 were males. But one of the great things, in which we've mentioned a little bit earlier, was the use of Narcan. We had 14 Narcan uses with 12 successful reversals. So the more Narcan that's out there, the more reversals we get, the more lives that we save. But in 2020, up to this date, we've had 12 overdoses with 2 deaths, 2 females, 10 males, 8 Narcan uses, 8 successful reversals, and 2 of the deaths Narcan wasn't used at all. So had Narcan been there, you know, it could have been 2 more lives saved. Right. But so basically between 2020 January to August and 2019 January to August, we are at exactly the same number of ODs, 12 ODs at this time in 2019. But we are one less death than we were last year. So, you know, if we can keep that Narcan training, get the community, get the listeners out there, tell your friends, tell your family to get Narcan, to carry Narcan. You never know when you come across somebody that you don't even know. It doesn't, you know, you don't have to keep it, or you can just keep it for your family members if you have somebody that's struggling with a substance use disorder. But just having that out there in the community for somebody to be able to use Narcan on somebody they don't know can save a life, and you know, it's just Narcan's just a great drug,
right?
You know.
And just to let you know, I know our schedules haven't lined up, but from the patrol first responder side, it's, in my experience, we go to calls and everybody gets caught up in the emergency, and then the person might go to the hospital or wherever they need to go, and it's me and some family, and they're kind of looking at me, and we've come a long way from.
Right, okay. And that's where First Step helps out. It relieves the patrol sergeant with a person to sit with the individual that just overdosed, and also the advocates that are coming in dealing with the families. So now the patrol officer doesn't have to deal with families and the questions. There's already somebody there on scene that can do that.
Yeah, I think it's much more than just sitting. I mean, we're here for people. I can sit there, but the program that you have, instead of just saying we're here for you, it's offering those avenues, and it's done so much for us on the patrol side.
And I just want to enter. I have to highlight that what is happening here is so incredible. To see law enforcement and treatment or community agency partnering together so well, it is not happening in other places in the state, in the nation. Mm-hmm. Wherever, you know, if you think about it, we're from two different schools of thoughts. I treat patients, you guys have criminals. But now we're on the same page and say we're treating these individuals and getting them help. It's just incredible. So the work that's happening and will continue to happen in the partnership, I got to highlight that because it's not being done other places.
It's not common, and it's really, when you talk about, I remember in the beginning when I knew very little, and it was about, you know, bridging gaps, removing barriers. I was like, what in the world is this? And what I learned is we all don't want to, we can only do what we can do in our own little lanes. And for our organization, we were trying to figure out, what is our lane? What do we do? And that took getting to know what was in the community and understanding where everyone's level was interested in, and awareness and interest in how can we do better by knowing better. Because that's the thing, is we can't change what we've done in the past. We look at what we've done in the past to help us guide where we are today and use what we know today to do better for tomorrow. And the thing is in our little neck of the woods, we really are bridging these gaps of where people have this moment where there's an overdose death, I need help. And we're really finding the ways to get into that as a collaborative partnership and then saying, okay, what is your willingness? Because if there's 0.05 willingness, there is hope. There's hope of that breath to say, okay, you want treatment? You don't want treatment. You want somebody that knows what you're feeling? Okay, here. And that's the beauty of what y'all were willing to do before there was anything. When y'all were first saying, so how can we help in this epidemic? How can we help in this crisis? And, you know, some people can say, how can we help? And that's all I'm going to say, how can we help? And then they hear, and then they stay put. Y'all were willing to get right in the, and I say y'all, but as law enforcement, y'all were willing to get right along beside treatment, mm-hmm. community, and sit in that space to where, okay, how can we do something different that hasn't been done in our state, hasn't been done in the states around us, but somewhere way far away, we can look at that and build this out with our own unique language. And that's something that, that's not common, and there's a lot to be said for that. Sitting in that uncomfortable space, building something as we fly it. And
I can tell you there was times that I was wondering if this would work, and you know, how successful would it be. And I can tell you the moment that I realized that this was an extremely successful partnership was when I got a call out of the blue from somebody that heard that the police department will help you if you have an addiction. And then I received that call, and they said, hey, sorry, is this Sergeant Winstead? Can you help me? I have this going on, and I knew exactly where to send them. I had, you know, I had the resources that are sitting at this table that I knew I can send them to one of the three, and I knew that they would have their questions answered, and if they needed any type of medical assistance, they or counseling or anything, that they would get that. So at that point, I realized that this is an extremely successful partnership. And I wish it could be done in some form or fashion all over the United States, because I think getting different organizations together for the same goal that do multifaceted functions is going to be key to you know,
making things better one life at
certainly
a time.
Do more exactly working together. There was one thing I wanted to throw out there to kind of wrap up, and maybe it's about taking that first step for a parent or a family member or something like that, but are there any warning signs that somebody could be looking for as a family member or loved one or something that somebody is looking for some information that could start somewhere?
Yeah, absolutely. So I can only speak, I'm not a father, so I can't speak from the parent angle, but what I can tell you from a person in long-term recovery myself, but also from loved ones that noticed a change in me, you know, so... you often hear parents say that they started to realize that their child was disappearing right in front of their eyes. And so, first and foremost, it's in my experience, it was kind of a change of behavior. So, slowly but surely, I lost that light in my eye a little bit. And then at the end of the throes of my addiction, it was completely gone. And so I don't say that. It's just, you know, of course, as children get older, there's going to be, you know, just normal, you know, a teenager being a teenager or a 12-year-old or a 30.
Yes.
So I never want to alarm folks that, like, normal, you know, developmental changes are not normal. But for me, in speaking with my loved ones that were close to me during that time physically, they started to notice elongated periods of sleeping. And for me, being a former opioid user, it was changes in my breathing patterns or even, you know, just elevated snoring, you know, so things that were out of the ordinary for what I had always been like my entire life. And since then, those type of sleep habits or breathing issues, things like that have been alleviated with sobriety. But it's also just changed patterns in terms of things. For me, things started to go missing. And there was a significant loss in weight. And so those are the things that I mean by missing, you
right.
know, normal health things. I just did not appear healthy. And so
there's not an elaborate.
There's not. And there's not like I wish there was a book that says if you experience this,
right.
this means that, you know, it can look
mm-hmm.
different from everyone. But the thing is that with all of these resources in the community, these loved ones don't have to kind of go it alone. So they can call Charleston Center and say, like, hey, is this person
right.
fit for detox? Or,
right.
hey, Wake Up Carolina, is this something you experienced as a parent or me, someone in recovery? But those are some of the first things that kind of go in my experience.
And this might sound pretty basic, and I think a lot of people would be scared to ask somebody.
Yeah.
Is there really a bad way to try to check on somebody? Because I wouldn't think that there is.
Personally,
no.
I mean,
no, but.
No, but, you know, obviously, human to human, just, you know.
Right.
What I encourage people when I'm talking to family and loved ones is really be mindful in how you ask, because sometimes the intention is good, like, you're concerned. But if the question is, are you doing drugs?
Right.
Know that you're probably going to get a defensive response.
Right.
So framing a question in the way of, hey, I've just been noticing some things lately, and I'm concerned about you. Like, are you feeling okay? Is everything coming from a stance where it's more of genuine concern versus, you know, asking that hard-hitting question first, because you'll often be met with defense.
Yeah.
And we encourage people to call us at the Charleston Center. I have many families that just reach out too. One, they'll just explain some of their child's behavior patterns and say, what do you think's going on here? And we'll give some feedback and or some medical clarification. But yeah, also how can we help you have those conversations? It's uncomfortable.
Right.
Sure.
And I can imagine that, like, if it was one of my friends, I'd get right up in their face
right.
and be like, hey man, what's going on? You know. But as a parent, I would have I think denial would try to get a hold of me real quick, because no parent wants to think that their kid is going down that road.
Exactly.
It's
and that's
so
the
common.
Dangerous thing is the denial. Like, oh
right.
no, this is not what I think it is.
But denial is always the first part of it. In the beginning, it is always
right.
the first part. It's how long you sit in that space.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
right.
And we say that. We also say secrets keep people sick. And,
right.
And oftentimes we find people shy away from those conversations because of their own discomfort. Or because
we also
they
don't
want
know the
to know,
answers,
but they don't want to
when
know
I know
the
answer,
well,
I have
and
to
that's,
do something.
That's
yeah.
that, right.
When
that
I know
right.
the answer, I will have to do something.
Right.
And it is, you know, any space for a parent or a loved one to think, did I do something wrong? What, you know, I've given my child all of these things. And so those questions naturally come up, and
mm-hmm.
we want to help navigate and normalize that may come up, but let us help walk you through that and talk to you about that, because, you know, this is a disease of the brain and has behavioral components, and, you know, you're not in this fight alone.
I was going to say, too, from my own experience, I thought it was very unique, or I was unique, I wasn't. And that's the thing is by the time you really, because there's a, you know, when I spoke at one place, I was like, if you look at the typical physical, emotional, and cognitive behaviors or you know, behaviors of a teenager or adolescent, if that's what we're talking about right now, they're almost identical to someone, and this is true. I encourage you to look at it. And you look at a young adult, that is symptomatic of this chronic disease or just misusing substances, they're almost all identical. So you're not crazy to not know what the answer is. Mm-hmm. And 9 times out of 10, the immediate response to someone in the community or someone that finds out someone is in treatment or something like that, well, how did the family not know? The family should know. Mm-hmm. I can tell you from experience and from those that I serve, the family is the last one to know. Because when you love someone that is suffering, the last thing, no matter what the symptoms of their lying, cheating, stealing, hurt, all of this is showing their family, the last thing that individual that's suffering wants to do is hurt their loved one. And so the key, even if you're not comfortable in calling any of us or the resources, educate yourself. Look at what addiction is. This is not a moral failing. If a parent or a spouse had any control over the outcome of someone from not having the disease of addiction or the chronic disease, they would be graduating number one from high school, going on a scholarship to college, or going to the Merchant Marines to do exactly what your dream is for your child. We don't have that control, just like our parents didn't have that control, or we wouldn't be where we are now. The thing is, this is a brain disease. It is a chronic brain disease. Educate yourself, because that will start helping keep that voice in your head quiet that it's your fault. What you're looking at is symptomatic because you didn't do something up. You got divorced. You didn't have enough money. You moved schools. You transferred. If all of that was the case, your child wouldn't be where they are. So educate yourself that it's a brain disease. Educate yourself what the symptoms are. And then you will feel more empowered to make that phone call, to reach out to someone in the community or whatever it is. But educate yourself when you start getting that nudging. That nudging was probably there all along, and you're finally hearing it because it's so loud and ringing now.
You want to just say any like final thoughts?
You know, one thing that I think is a key tool is that you have many community distributors in the Tri-County area. Charleston Center is a community distributor of Narcan. Wake Up Carolina is a community distributor. And what that means is if you need Narcan, you call the Charleston Center, Wake Up Carolina, and we can train you one-on-one, safe distancing, as little as 15 minutes or all the way up to an hour, whatever you need. But also, if you don't live in this Tri-County area, you can go to justplainkillers.com. And it will show you a list of all the community distributors of Narcan in the state. And the Narcan is free. And if you go through the Narcan, you go to where you got it from, and you get another one for free. And this comes through grants to the state of South Carolina.
And you can also go to local retail pharmacies. You do not need a prescription for Narcan. So if you wanted to go to your local pharmacy, you can also pick it up there. But in addition to reaching out to one of our agencies.
And Bill, I have one final thought before I stop talking, is that I just want everybody, all the listeners out there, to know that if you're struggling, if you need help with any type of addiction counseling, treatment, or just need to talk to somebody, you can always call the police department. You can dial 843-884-4176, and you can ask for any officer. You can ask for me personally, Sergeant Tony Winstead, and we will give you a call. But one of the things that I'm going to end with, and I saw this quote, and it's my second favorite quote, and it'll stick with me the rest of my life, is broken crayons still color. So if you feel broken, guess what? You can always get help, and you're always going to be able to make that beautiful coloring, that beautiful picture. So I'm just going to end with that, and because that sticks with me.
I just want to thank you all for being here today. Nancy, Sergeant Winstead, Caitlin, Nate, I think the conversation we had today was so important. And one last thing. We would like to dedicate today's podcast in memory of Gina Gregory. Gina Gregory died of an overdose on August 4th. She was the sister of our own Officer Bryce Gregory. Our thoughts and prayers are with the Gregory family.
Thank you for listening to the MPPD podcast.